Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not all boring super committee stuff all the time, you know. Sometimes the economic news is real economic news. And so today on the broadcast, GDP, jobs, and housing. You know, the stuff that really matters. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 22nd of November. Good to have you with us. And listen, let's do this, all right? Get away from the politics of the American economy, deficits and super committees and Congress and all that, and seek refuge in the numbers, the pure, unadulterated essence of economic measurement. Sound good? Yeah, I hope so, because we got some new numbers from the Commerce Department today. Their revised estimate of what happened to gross domestic product, GDP in the vernacular, in the third quarter. New data from July through September suggests the economy grew at an annual rate of 2%. That's a half percentage point less than they originally guessed. But still, not all bad news, as Marketplace's David Gura reports now from Washington.
When it comes to economic indicators, GDP is the big one. It's the value of all goods and services we produce. Nigel Gault is an economist at IHS Global Insights.
By the fact that it's all-inclusive, it is the single most important indicator of activity.
David Ressler with Nomura Securities says you have to take that number apart to see what really happened.
Economists tend to look at GDP in disaggregated form.
They look at what goes into it, like how much consumers and businesses spent in the third quarter. The Commerce Department said spending was up by about 3.5%. But companies were worried about demand and had slimmed down inventories.
You know, things on shelves that businesses sell to other firms or to consumers.
Gus Fouché is with Moody's Analytics. He says companies were influenced by economic uncertainty, things like the debt ceiling debate and the S&P downgrade. Nigel Gault says companies erred on the side of caution.
I think it turned out that their worst fears weren't realized. Sales probably held up a bit better than they'd anticipated, so they were left with probably fewer goods on the shelf.
And higher demand means they may have to ramp up production. Stuart Hoffman is with PNC Financial Services.
If they have a half-decent holiday season, and we think they will, they actually find they're going to have to restock those shelves after the holiday into the first part of next year.
And that could mean more growth in the fourth quarter. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The most recent numbers we have for economic growth in Egypt are semi-reliable. Best guesses are it's about 1% so far this year, which is bad enough, but only part of the reason that tens of thousands of people have been in Tahrir Square in Cairo the past couple of days. Today, the military government there said it's going to shift to civilian rule earlier than previously promised following elections next week. Nabil Mansour runs the Osiris Hotel in Cairo. It's about a 3-minute walk from the square, he tells us. And Mr. Mansour, welcome to the program.
Yeah, you are welcome, yes.
Let me start by asking you this, Mr. Mansour. What has it been like for you the past 10 months since January?
Yeah, 10 months is going up and going down, going up and going down. Yeah, so we have like 2 months have no people, actually one room or two rooms.
Only one room or two rooms rented out?
Yeah. And then we have some, last month we are working not bad, like 40%, something like that.
40%, but still, how are you making? Are you making any money? You can't be making any money.
No. No one makes money in this moment. But people still need to have some place to sleep.
Yeah.
Even if you have one room or two rooms.
Yeah, but what do you do? How do you pay your suppliers? How do you pay your workers? I mean, how do you survive?
Yeah, you pay from your pocket, yeah. So.
You pay from your pocket.
Yeah. This is true, yeah. So.
Do you have very deep pockets?
No.
So it can't last very long, can it, if you don't have very big pockets?
Yeah. You're obligated, you know. Sometimes you're obligated to do something you are not like, yeah, but...
So what would you see happen? I mean, clearly, you know, you're losing money, your business is at risk. What do you want to have happen?
Yeah, you cannot stop your job, you know. You cannot, because I live in the place, you know, so I cannot stop this job. And you cannot tell your guests, we are closed and go out.
Yeah. What do you think is going to happen in the elections on the 28th?
I, I, wanted to have everyone quiet and everyone choice what he choice, like these people from the government, and everything's be changed for the good, for the best. Everyone like his country, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, we like our country, and we like Egypt, and we like the people to be better. This everyone wants that.
Yeah. So, you know, we have a saying in this country. It goes around election time, and it goes, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? So are you better off now than you were?
No. We are not better than before, but we hope to be better after.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time, sir.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye now.
You are welcome. Bye.
Nabil Mansour at the Osiris Hotel in Cairo today. Trading on the benchmark Egyptian stock index was stopped today at one point, so volatile was the trading. Wall Street was choppy as well, not that bad, though we'll have the details when we do the numbers. David Gura's story about gross domestic product spins nicely into the economic chicken and egg argument of the moment, which goes a little something like this. What's going to come first, jobs or economic growth? This week, we're asking people who write about work to share their views on the topic at hand. Today, Barbara Ehrenreich.
My family was originally blue collar. My father had been a miner, a copper miner in Butte, Montana. And I was raised to respect everybody's work. I handed it to my parents. They said, you know, whatever anybody's doing, they're scrubbing a floor, you've got to respect that. There's no question that the working class is much harder hit than white-collar people in this recession. Just if you looked over the last 3 years at who was being laid off, the real carnage has been among blue-collar workers and disproportionately among Black and Latino workers. In all this talk about how we need more jobs, 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 let us not forget that that's not going to do much good unless the jobs pay enough to live on.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the author, most recently, of Bright-Sided, How Positive Thinking is Undermining America. Tomorrow, our series continues with Jess Walter. You, of course, don't have to wait for tomorrow. Send us your comments today. If you go to marketplace.org, click on the link that says contact. Yesterday on the broadcast, Mitchell Hartman took us out east of Los Angeles to a place called the Inland Empire, Riverside and San Bernardino counties. For decades, it was a place where people went to find their way into the middle class. And they went for the cheap housing. They stayed for the good jobs. But back in the day, unemployment wasn't even an issue. Now, though, it tops every major metropolitan area in the country except Las Vegas. And in the struggling city of Rialto, people have been hit especially hard by the double crash in housing and jobs. Today, Mitchell tells us where they're finding shelter.
You want something to drink? You want a cup of coffee?
Patio West Deli has served up sandwiches and salads on Rialto's main drag for 30 years, including their signature sandwich.
Egg salad with crispy pastrami and add avocado to it, your cheese, lettuce, tomato, and sprouts, and it's pretty doggone awesome.
Well, not on my diet, but co-owner Gloria Miller says it's a huge hit with her lunch crowd, which unfortunately is smaller than ever. Many stores nearby are boarded up.
We have a lot of regular people that are very loyal to us, but they've cut back on the number of times that they can come in a week or a month or whatever.
Same goes for restaurants and strip malls along Route 66, a couple miles from downtown. So where is everybody? Seems like they all went to church. Sunrise Church in Rialto is a sprawling evangelical center surrounded by suburban tract housing. Every Sunday, families fill the huge parking lot. They arrive in late model SUVs and rusty old sedans, but all in their Sunday best to get their spiritual fill.
Matthew 6, verses 19 to 21. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal.
But in the huge main sanctuary, the preacher's sermon is projected on oversized video screens. In a second auditorium, the Spanish service is in full sway.
Gracias, Señor. Gracias porque tú eres santo.
The senior pastor is Jay Pankratz. Thin, white-haired, and intense, he's built this church from a few hundred mostly white upper-middle-class members a few decades ago to more than 5,000 today. He did it by embracing the wave of Black and Hispanic families migrating here for cheap housing and blue-collar jobs. Now that his church serves the high and the low, economic trouble has come knocking.
Every week there are people who come to me in tears, families that have lost houses or are about to, have lost jobs. Just like this last weekend, I got a note again, please pray for us, you know, with about 4 exclamation points at the end.
Pankratz isn't just praying. The church regularly holds financial literacy classes. There's a men's group on work readiness and job hunting. And after services, congregants head over to the church's new relief mission on the poor side of town.
Thank you so much.
No problem. God bless you. Make sure you bring the box back.
De tres a cuatro podemos
ir. Retiree Albert Grigsby and truck mechanic Mario Rojas hand out 60 boxes of donated food and clothing every Sunday.
There's times we knocked on doors in the neighborhood we went in, and I've had people to walk out and hug me and start crying because they didn't have any food in their house.
What we're trying to do is provide people with some physical food, but not only that, also spiritual food.
As we head back to the Mother Church, keep that thought in mind, because providing succor for people's material troubles goes hand in hand with providing spiritual succor to save their souls. Pastor Pankratz gathers those souls in with a message of moderation and frugality.
Jesus goes on to say, you cannot serve both God and money. It's okay to drive a generic car. It's okay to live in a 60-year-old house. I do. The heroes are the ones who are content with what they have so they can invest in the lives of others.
And then the collection buckets come out and people stuff wads of tens, twenties, even hundreds inside, which helps the church fund its relief work and keep opening branches in neighboring towns. It also helps that wealthier members give a tithe, 10% of income, every year. For some, though, it's getting harder to answer that call.
So I've been through like 3 recessions, but I've never been through one like this one. Usually it comes back, and it's not coming back at all.
Jerry Yurta is pushing 60. He's a small business owner and pillar of the church. But for the first time in 39 years, he and his wife just missed a house payment. Seems he'd be in line for some of that Christian charity the church offers, except...
I probably would never ask him for money. I mean, because I've always been one that helps give the money and give the tithe, and it would probably be really hard for me to ask for help.
So who's going to help Jerry Yurta save his house and his business? Looks like it'll have to be the economy itself. And so far, that hasn't been working out so well in the Inland Empire. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've got pictures from the pulpit and from that charity mission at our website. Also, maps that let you see how much better unemployment is where you live than in the Inland Empire. Our website, wait for it, oh yeah, marketplace.org. Coming up, work? Yeah, they got that in North Dakota. Places to live? Yeah, no.
We have people literally sleeping in trees and all kinds of things here.
But first, let's do the numbers. So the Dow Industrials lost 53 points today, nearly a 0.5%, closed at 11,493. The NASDAQ took off a point, less than a 0.1%, 2521. The S&P 500 dropped 4 points, 0.4%, finished at 1188. Commerce Department said our economic growth the last few months was slower than expected. As we said, that hurt conglomerates like General Electric, United Technologies Group, and Siemens. All three switched off more than 1.3% today. Yum Brands gobbled up a 2% gain. The owner of KFC, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut is going to spin off its India operations to focus on rapid growth there. Campbell's Soup spilled 5.25% lower due to less than appetizing earnings. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.92%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Census Bureau releases durable goods orders for October. The Labor Department releases weekly unemployment insurance claims. And President Obama holds the 64th annual turkey pardoning in the Rose Garden. The relieved turkey will travel in a horse-drawn carriage to George Washington's Mount Vernon estate, where it can be viewed by all. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We celebrate the bounty this week, right? That's what the Big Meal Thursday is supposed to be about? Well, kind of depends. Those who work on Wall Street will have slightly less bounty this year. Still ample, but less. Estimates are year-end bonuses will be down as much as 30% when all's said and done. Our series, Economy 4.0, is all about how to make the financial system work better for more people, not just the 1%. So Marketplace's David Brancaccio is here to talk shrinking bonuses with us. Hey, David.
Hey there.
All right, so this is breaking my heart, man. Bonuses on Wall Street going down? Come on.
Yeah, the average bonus last year was $130,000. This time around, just a simple $100,000 on average. That'll be for the stock guys. People in bonds, the bonus could be down even more.
But, I mean, why? What is there something physically happening?
Well, market conditions, right? If they're not making big profits, yeah. Eventually it does trickle down to your bonus, it turns out. But the other thing is this big regulatory process. That's a big word for Washington is trying to clamp down. Because remember back in 2008 what happened?
Yeah.
Right as the bailout is being deployed, it turns out that Wall Street is giving itself $18 billion, with a B, dollars in bonuses.
All right. So, I mean, Washington is having its own, you know, issues nowadays. But what are they doing about bonuses? How are they cracking down? Tell me how it's working.
It's not supposed to be this big punishment for some people getting paid a lot of money. It's supposed to be about rethinking compensation so that traders don't have this huge incentive to take big risks that might pay off but also could go bad, destroying the economy and causing bailouts. Now, the typical way of thinking about this, right, is tie compensation, tie bonuses to stock prices. That'll keep them disciplined. But listen to what Martin Bailey at Brookings said.
A lot of people are so, you know, used to the idea that you want to align the incentives of the managers with the incentives of shareholders that they can't think about the fact that really that's not quite right for the financial sector.
So you get like the shareholders, they may like the risk taking. It's just that if the risk taking goes bad, you and me, society suffers.
Yeah, well, which brings me to the thing you said a minute ago before the piece of tape, this idea of punishment. I would venture that if we go out outside the studios and ask 10 people what we should do about bonuses on Wall Street, they would say we ought to make them pay us. We ought to punish them for what they've done to the economy. How do we square that with what's going on actually in the regulatory process?
No, exactly. And how do we square the fact they're still working on these rules in Washington all these years
mm-hmm.
later, right?
Right.
No, they're not thinking about that at all. What they are thinking about is something a little bit more practical. It has to do with please disclose what your bonuses and your compensation is, always nice. And the other thing they're working on is deferring compensation. Maybe the guy and the women don't get their bonuses right away, but it comes in 2 years, 3 years. And if their bets don't go bad, they can keep all their money.
This is kind of an extraordinary conversation to be having when unemployment's at 9% and we're still down 8 million jobs, and yet Wall Street and the financial sector are talking $100,000 bonuses.
And it's amazing how tough it is to do anything about this. Listen to Charles Elson, director of the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance, about what happens if bonuses are shoved down one way or another.
We've seen the base pay go up as a way around the limitation on the bonus, and that's not so good either. Do you really want to guarantee a large, hefty salary for someone who you think has really not done the greatest job? Anytime the government inserts itself into the pay process, bad things happen.
I love that little chuckle, right, where he said, not done the greatest job.
And it's really cool that if you work in banking, you're so clever with money that you can
right.
always figure out a way to get yourself paid.
All right. Before we wrap it up, let me ask you one question. Actually, it's just three words. You ready?
Yeah.
Occupy Wall Street.
Well, what that does is it keeps pressure, in theory, on the people with their regulatory plans in Washington. It means the whole world is watching. You know, what's the plan, Washington? That's the question coming from Occupy Wall Street.
What's the plan? Indeed. David Brancaccio and our series Economy 4.0. Thank you, David.
You bet.
For those who might be wondering where Occupy Wall Street goes physically, now that officials in a lot of cities seem to have had enough, Los Angeles has something a little bit different. Last night, the city made an offer to Occupy LA protesters, a little bit of shelter in exchange for getting off the lawn out front of City Hall. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports on how that bargain's being received.
Hundreds of tents, tarps, and giant works of art have covered City Hall lawn for 7 weeks. Occupier Benjamin Torres says the city's been fair to campers. The mayor even handed out ponchos on a rainy day. He says the city hopes to avoid the violent confrontations with police it's seen in the past.
They can't really be as brass as they've been in other cities. They know what the outcome will be.
Thus, a push for a third way. An Occupy LA delegation says city officials have offered protesters an office building, land for an urban farm, and permanent housing for homeless members of the movement if the tent city folds up. Torres says some occupiers see this as a chance for the movement to mature, but not him.
I think we have housing here, and I think it's a tease.
He says the point of Occupy is to be out in public. Elizabeth Jacobs at the Brookings Institution says it'll be tough for L.A. to strike a deal with everyone.
It's not clear to me from the government side how exactly you enforce the agreement.
Even if some occupiers sign on and move to cubicles, others will likely stay and face down police. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Remember when Alan Greenspan said we didn't really have a housing bubble in this country? What we had was a whole lot of froth? Mitchell Hartman's story from California's Inland Empire earlier in the program was one version of how that theory turned out. Another comes to us from North Dakota, where small towns used to struggle because so many people were leaving. These days, thanks to an oil boom, they're struggling because so many people are coming in. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports now from Williston, North Dakota.
In most of the country, jobs are nowhere to be found. And vacant houses are pretty much everywhere. That's not the case in North Dakota. Just ask Tom Rolfstad, head of economic development for the town of Williston.
I can almost get anyone a job here probably the day they get here, but finding them a place to stay is a real challenge. I mean, we have people literally sleeping in trees and all kinds of things here.
The reason people are sleeping in makeshift tree houses? A yellow flame soars into the night sky just outside Williston. It's natural gas burn-off from oil drilling. Fires like these fill the skyline in the northwestern part of the state. They mark one of the largest oil reserves in the world, and the hiring frenzy that's happened since companies figured out how to tap that oil 5 years ago. Lynn Helms is with the Department of Mineral Resources.
It has changed every business in almost every way. We've brought 24,000 jobs into North Dakota just to service the drilling rigs.
In just 5 years, Williston's population has gone from 12,000 people to more than 20,000. Now every company, from McDonald's to Halliburton, is desperate for workers. And those workers are desperate for a place to sleep. Many apartments have two-year waiting lists. RV parks are overflowing. Dozens of workers live in their cars in the parking lot of the local Walmart. They join gyms just to have a place to shower.
It's not easy out here, definitely.
Oil truck driver Derek Gerard lives in a trailer he towed from Idaho. He says the payout here is great. Oil workers earn an average of $80,000 a year, but the life is hard.
There's a lot of turnaround because a lot of people can't handle it. It takes toughness to go away from your family and from your friends to come out and do work like this.
For many oil field workers, the best housing option is a man camp. These temporary housing units line the road. They look like collections of metal shipping containers. Manager Dennis Ripley shows me one of this camp's 200 cramped rooms.
So in here, they have their own single bed, a captain's type bed with the drawers underneath.
There's a rec room, a gym, and three really hearty meals a day.
Got pork chops with a choice of applesauce or gravy, pepper steak, beef rice, roast potatoes, pasta and red sauce, corn, and zucchini. With a choice of dinner.
Most workers eat all of that. The rooms cost $125 a day. Oil companies usually foot the bill. Forklift driver Adam Martin is being put up here by his company. That is, until it finishes building a house for him and his wife.
That was the agreement that I have with my company, that I come up here and they provide family living. Some people have a pocket full of money but nowhere to live.
Oil transport company Missouri Basin Trucking is spending $10 million to build housing for its workers. CFO Tony Houck shows me the planned neighborhood.
80 apartment units and 12 duplex units. This is just an example of what our company has going, and every other company around here is doing things similar to this. So
Williston's Tom Rolfstad is glad to see efforts like this. He worries that if the city relies too much on man camps and RV parks, it will become a town where people, mostly men, drift in for a couple years to earn money.
Our mission right now is to go more for family. People want to move here to be a long-term part of our community. So getting housing development going is big for us.
In the past, Williston added about 5 new houses a year. This year, it will get 2,000 new homes. And that's still not even close to enough. In Williston, North Dakota, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which the economic stimulus package of 2009 returns. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said today the tail end of the $800 billion or so that Congress authorized 2.5 years ago added 0.3% to the third quarter GDP number that came out this morning. As these things tend to go, though, it was vague in a couple of key areas. How many jobs the stimulus package added, just for one? Anywhere from 500,000 to 3.3 million, which is a margin of error of, I don't even know. All right, that's it. We got to go. Somebody will tell me, right? That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 53 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ took off a point less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 dropped 4 points, 0.4%. Thanks today to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time, back here, a man and his sandwich.
I go out and I get a sandwich, or I make a sandwich, and I put it on a flatbed scanner, and I scan it.
It's tasty, but gets a little messy. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.